This episode of Medic Mindset is supported by iSimulate. From the very beginnings of this podcast, I've been committed to keeping Medic Mindset always and forever free. Their support allows me to do that. Thank you, iSimulate.
This comes down to this core tenet of leadership. The most important thing that a leader can create for the people that work for them is safety. Building rapport is vital to leadership. The people who say, no, you have to be standoffish and all that kind of thing, I think they're really impairing their own ability to lead.
My question is, would you follow you?
Would I follow me? As men would follow him, if only out of morbid curiosity.
Would you follow you? Welcome to Medic Mindset. I'm Ginger Locke. The guest in this episode is Dr. J.R. Pickett. If you're a regular of the show or you work in EMS in Texas, for sure you know him as the White Tiger. He's been the Deputy Medical Director at Austin Travis County EMS and recently announced that he's leaving us and heading to Utah. And while I'm sad that he's leaving Austin, I'm thrilled that another region of the country will get to experience what medics here have enjoyed during his tenure. We've talked in previous episodes about medical education and clinical topics in the Thinking Shortness of Breath and Thinking Syncope episodes. And this time, we do something different. He shares his leadership philosophy. We wanted to record one more time in person before he set off, and it occurred to me that he may be in this beautiful season of life and beautiful season in his career where he might be doing a lot of reflecting on what he's accomplished here, what he hopes to do next, and he did not disappoint. I normally would just let you listen for yourself and not put too many caveats on it before we start, but I want to point out one thing. I didn't notice it during recording. I only noticed it during editing. At the beginning of the episode, he talks about this conversational tactic where you simply say, after someone else shares something, if you want to build on what they've said or pivot a little bit, you just say yes and instead of yes but. I've always found conversations with him flow really easily, and I've never really known exactly what it was he was doing to make that the case. But in this episode, he tells us his tactic. And then if you listen for the rest of the episode, you'll hear him doing it over and over. When I chime in, he'll build on that or pivot with a yes and. He practices what he preaches. He's the real deal. Here he is, White Tiger. I've always marveled at the fact that you're a theater guy. Do you think of yourself as a theater guy?
I do. And a lot of folks get lost in this. Like, oh, you're a drama major. And I was design production. I was a behind the scenes guy.
Oh, you weren't acting?
No, I wasn't an actor.
Oh, it's a better story if you were acting.
I know. And that's where a lot of people go. And they assume that I was. But no, I was a lighting designer, technical director.
But you still appreciate the theater.
Oh, very much so.
You were talking to me about improv comedy. Is that something you've done?
You always study a little bit when you're doing your theater training. So you study directing, you study acting. And improv comedy is something that you do look at. And I think that there is something about improv comedy that informs our leadership style. So when you're doing improv comedy with somebody, the worst thing you can do is cut them off. Like, you know, shut them down, push them out of that scene, because that improv comedy, it's that give and take that you have. And you are partners in the creation of this show and making the audience laugh and getting the audience engaged. So the worst thing you could possibly do is leave them no outs when you're improvising with them. And so one of the things we frequently teach is the yes and. So whatever it is that you say, my attitude towards that is yes and. So I'm building upon it. It's not yes but. So it's ands, not buts. In a leadership setting, in a collaboration setting, that's the same thing. If you want people to be shut out of what you're doing, if you want them to disengage from you or to see it as an adversarial relationship, then you do you do yes, but you cut them off of where they're at, rather than the yes and, which validates the way that they feel about a thing. And maybe you were negotiating on something where you have some differing opinions on how something should be done or what should be done. If you treat them like that's not valid, then they're going to put walls up. And you don't want those walls to be up. You want those walls to come down. So by having that attitude of yes and, that is, like Stephen Covey talks about in Seven Habits of Highly Effective People, that's a thinking win-win. I want you to get what you want. I want to get what I want. Let's see if we can both find a solution that gets us there. We talk about in politics, we talk about compromise, and you know, every negotiation is ultimately going to be a compromise. Every project is going to be a compromise. There's going to be some things that you want to accomplish, maybe you can't, or aspects of it that you envision, but somebody else has a better idea for how that should be accomplished. That's good. If you have the yes and, then you're receptive to those things because you are thinking, how can you build upon what they are saying, what they're bringing to the table there? And that's how you get buy-in.
Yeah. And it's not just a rhetoric mechanism where you just say yes and. I'm thinking about improv. You really have to hear what they said because you're about to build on their storytelling and improv, right? So you have to really listen.
Yes, absolutely. And you have to hear it and then see what you can add to make it better, or how you add to that to get what it is that you think should be included in whatever the thing is, the project, the proposal, the contract, the relationship.
So along the lines of buy-in, as a leader, you're not doing anything if you don't get buy-in, right? What other tools can you use to get buy-in?
Yeah, I think that is that's a million-dollar question, because as leaders, if you think like, I'm just going to push forward and make these things happen, if you don't have people following you, you're not a leader. You're just some person. Yeah. You're not creating much of anything. And you by yourself cannot create nearly as much as you can as when you have people that are on board with you, that are buying in to where you see things going. And there are so many books written on this. Of course, Simon Sinek, Start With Why, is a great one. Good Boss, Bad Boss, Switch, you know, How to Change When Change is Hard, Extreme Ownership. There's a lot of terrific books on this. No Excuses Leadership, talking about how to build that buy-in. You got to start with listening, you know, find out what is coming. Now, I'm going to be starting a new job very soon. It is in a leadership position. And it's funny, in talking with the folks who are like interim in that position and doing it, and they're asking, well, you know, you're still going to want me around and, you know, contribute? I was like, yeah. Like, why would I give up on that experience, that knowledge and all this stuff? Like, I'm the new guy. Like, you tell me what has been working so far and what hasn't been working so far, where you had seen things going, where the fellows want to see things going, and so forth. And now let's look at this future that gets you what you want. I think in EMS, when we're talking EMS leadership, no secret that this field in this country is still this nascent field. It just, we can't get out of our own way. Mm-hmm. That adherence to minimum standard, like how can we make it faster and cheaper and easier, and that anti-intellectualism, the pushback against degrees and further education in this field that really holds us back, then you got to ask, okay, what do people want? What do the medics want? They want to be validated. They want to feel like what they do matters. They want to see positive effect of what they do. They don't want to have the feeling that they just schlep people to the hospital, because that's not very meaningful work when it feels like that. So I think that asking first, like, what do you want out of this career field? And even the ones who say, you know, I just want to run my shifts and I just want to be left alone. That's actually just a trauma response. That's somebody who at some point got into this field, had visions of what it could be, and they were let down so many times.
Yeah.
That they're just punching the clock.
They lost that vision, that hope.
Yes. They've been let down so many times that they no longer have an inkling or a hope that it could get better. And it's like, well, okay, I get paid for doing the job. The way I do it is not very hard. So That's going to be it.
So in the position that you're taking on, you're going to be in a leadership role, and it sounds like you got to talk to people there that were open enough and vulnerable enough to say, are you still going to need me? And that's so cool that they were able to say that, but I think a lot of people don't say it, right? They just kind of go over into their corner and they brood or whatever. So maybe that's a message, is that even if they're not asking, do you still need me? That as a leader, it's important to reassure those around you that you might be in still need them.
One of the fears that people have when you have a new leader coming in is that they've got their leadership style, they may have their visions for what they want to do, and nobody wants to get steamrolled by that new leader. If you can address that one right off the bat, that it would be arrogant of me to come into this job and say, oh yeah, we're going to change all this stuff, and this is all this, the vision that I have of what this could be and what we're going to do. That really, it's arrogant of me to think that I have this idea of how I should be doing something somewhere, an organization I've never been in, a place that I've never lived, working with people I've never met, to say, well, whatever you're doing it wrong, and I'm going to bring this change to it. Listening and getting that ground truth, but also giving people that safety that look, you've learned a lot of lessons here. Let's incorporate those lessons. Again, yes, and.
Have you heard the advice when you come on somewhere new to just for the first 6 months, just kind of listen and sit back? I think that's easy. Like if you're joining a team, I'm just a team member, but as a leader, they're kind of expecting you to have a voice right away.
Yes. And I think that it is even more important as the leader to come on listening, because again, one of the things that people do not want is they don't want a leader that doesn't listen. They don't want a leader who steamrolls them. This comes down to this core tenet of leadership. The most important thing that a leader can create for the people that work for them is safety.
Psychological safety.
Psychological safety and physical safety too. But yeah, psychological safety, the safety to be heard, to proffer their ideas, the safety to make mistakes, that safety to contribute, to achieve, et cetera. If you don't have that, then you're not going to get the best work out of somebody. You're not going to get somebody that brings great ideas if they think they're going to get monkey stomped when they bring those ideas. Right off the bat, if you come in as a leader, like, I'm going to do all this stuff and I'm going to change the way that you function day to day, I'm going to do that in the beginning, it's extremely disruptive. You're buying resistance right off the bat, because the way that people respond to that is, man, I don't know what he's doing, but I'm not on board with this attitude.
Right. Triggers this visceral response. It just shuts them down.
Exactly. Yeah. This automatic resistance of that, because what's happened is you've come in as a leader. You have not given any thought to what they want or think. So why should I believe that the leader will ever listen to me? They came into this job right off the bat wanting to change things without knowing what ideas we've got, what's worked, how I feel. Why then would I think that you'd ever do that in the future?
You referenced Simon Sinek, and his book is
Start With Why.
Start With Why. You were telling me one of your favorite leadership quotes is from him. Is it that book?
I don't know. Actually, this was from a video lecture from him. I do watch a lot of clips from him. I think he's got a lot of insightful stuff about leadership attitude in general. One of my favorite quotes from him, though, is to sacrifice those who work for you is to violate a deeply held social contract.
Sacrificing someone, like throwing them under the bus?
Yes. Throwing them under the bus, firing them, reassigning them, blaming them for something. My initial assumption of everybody I work with is that everybody's doing the best job that they can, the best job that they have the support and equipment and the decision space and the perceived safety to do it. If they're not giving great work, then what's missing from those pieces? Frequently, it's just the feeling like they can bring forth these ideas, that they can run with ideas. And can you give them that space? Can you help encourage them? Can you change that? Like we were talking about that minimalist that says, yeah, I just show up to work. Is there a way that you can reach that person to where then they do start giving you these ideas and they do re-engage? Sometimes you can't. Sometimes it's too far gone. It is what it is.
I would guess that one of your strategies to reach that person would be to go have a beer with them.
I absolutely think so. And so So Al Capone said, you get farther with a kind word and a gun than you do with a kind word alone. I take the opposite approach. You get farther with a kind word and a taco than you do with a kind word alone, which is why I love to meet over food, over coffee, over drinks, because that gives you that social safety where you're like, okay, I'm letting my guard down a little bit, and we're interacting as human beings first, before we're trying to tackle what is probably a difficult problem. I always want to start there, because I think also when you're in a standoff across a conference table with somebody trying to figure something out, and maybe you have maybe not diametrically opposed ideas and goals, there is going to be some amount of conflict there. It's a lot easier to interact with them if they see you as a human being. And, you know, it's a funny thing. When you're doing business, I've had a number of meetings overseas in these different cultures, and particularly like the Middle East. And I've seen how Americans are perceived. And when it comes to business, when it comes to official functions, and we're seen as very like straight to the point, brusque, and often rude in that sense. Like you sit down like, okay, let's do this thing, you know, or whatever, where you go to these other places, you start with a cup of tea or a cup of coffee, which sometimes works against you. Like I would do some hospital assessments, and like they start with a cup of coffee. And so by the time you're done with this hospital, you do it in every department. So you're like five espressos deep at the end of this assessment. And okay, I'm going to type up this five-page report, and I do it really fast because I'm so focused. Taking that time to step back, and even though you're in a meeting where you're talking about business, you're getting to know the person, they're getting to know you, and it's becoming a bit safer. Like, okay, she's not a terribly difficult person. Like, she's somebody that I can relate to. If it's a truly challenging situation, like there's been a loss of rapport either with you directly or with the folks that preceded you, maybe those first couple of meetings, you don't talk any business at all. Take the time to get to know them. If you're the leader and you're looking at your, whoever it is that you're interacting with, whether they're stakeholders, whether they're fellow leaders, whether they are subordinate to you, I hate that word, in that chain of command, maybe they are informal leaders within their organization, let them talk first. Let them give you an idea of who they are, what they're looking for. Now I've got an idea of what you want, because then I can tailor that message to, like, I have a vision for what wants to happen, but the way I want that message to come across is, here's how I'm going to help you get what you want.
Remember when you guys decided to no longer transport anyone on backboards at Austin Travis County?
No, there's still people who are doing it.
Well, that's unfortunate. Okay. Well, my understanding is that it's written that patients should not be transported on rigid backboards in the ambulance. They can be moved or whatever, but not transported. Right. How did that decision get made? And I don't really mean the science of it, but was that two people came together and they're like, yeah, we're doing this? Was it a decisive moment, or was it a slow progression where like, oh yeah, this makes sense after lots and lots of thought?
So back in like 2009, 2010, 2011, was starting to look at this. Like, man, why are we doing this? And I think kind of the index case that got me really thinking that this is something I wanted to be passionate about was I had a young guy that came in from a motor vehicle crash that was on a backboard. It wasn't a serious motor vehicle crash, but he's on a backboard. Get him in the emergency department. I log roll him off of this. This is just a kind of routine call. And I'm mashing down on his back, and I find some tenderness overlying the spine. And like, okay, cool. I scan him. You know, there's some redness there. He'd been laying on a backboard for a significant period of time. And I scan him, and all the scans are negative. And I go back in to see him, and like, hey, your scans are negative. Let me reexamine you and see how you're doing. And all of the tenderness was gone completely. I'm like, wow, if I'd had this exam before, then I never would have scanned the guy and submitted him to that time and expense and radiation and all of those bad things. And so this is where my whole backboards cause cancer thing comes from. In realizing that I wanted to make that change, as I was reviewing the literature and looking at work, you know, Mark Housewald is a true believer when it comes to this, and some of the stuff that he's published on it. And there's substantial evidence of harm. There's no evidence of benefit. It's a practice that crept in and then became just generationally just That's the one truth we have in EMS. I remember as a, the EMT being taught to do standing takedowns. Everybody knew somebody, that, I had this patient, they were fine. They had a little neck pain. They turned their head and then they pit themselves and now they're in a wheelchair, which has never actually been reported in the medical literature. This is a generational cultural change that been talking about this for over a decade. Still, there are folks that are just tightly adhered to that practice. You know, you can just make the change. And I hate this, they just say, well, they'll do it because I'm in charge. Like, try again. So it's going to take a lot of education and it's not going to be perfect right off the bat. You're not going to see the results that you want to see, especially if it's a large cultural shift. You're still going to have people that adhere to those practices. It's going to take a while and you just have to keep reinforcing that message, keep showing what you're proposing does work. And also people's peers, it helps that the peers also influence them in a lot of ways. And
so you're talking about how once it had been kind of written into protocol that the change is slowly kind of, it's getting there. But what I'm curious about is what does that look like for a medical director when they decide to, because I think it's written pretty, the words are should not be transported on a backboard, right? So it's pretty clear, which for me as an educator, it's really helpful because I can say that to the other faculty who, again, or students, right, that have been EMTs for 10 years, right? They're really holding on to it. I can say, well, look at this. This case study anyways, like look at this department. They're transporting, or the idea is to transport no one on backboard. So that's leadership. The part that I'm most curious about is what conversations happened. Was it your idea and who did you have to get buy-in from just to even get it written?
So, in Austin Travis County, the language in it is actually softer than what I want. Like there's may not, should not, shall not, right? I wanted it to be a shall not. They look like this is what we do, or in this case, don't do. And I wanted, I wanted to be that strong. It got softened because, there's these other departments that do this and so forth, that desire not to go significantly out in left field from where other departments are. I mean, there is that whole idea of a regional standard of care to where. To some extent, you're getting some vulnerability, some liability by not doing the thing that everybody else around you is doing. And I think that softened the language somewhat. But even then, even with that language, I was still seeing, years after making this, still seeing some medics that, they're keeping them on a board for no good reason.
As you were talking, it reminded me of when I worked for a department, our medical director, they said, I don't want to be the first to do something. I don't want to be the last to do something protocol wise. Do you agree with that? Is that your frame?
I've heard that many times over my career and I don't agree with that, but here's where the capricious comes in. Okay. I don't want to do something just because it's cool. I don't want the medics to like, hey, you can do this because look how cool we are to do that. I want it to be safe. I want it to be effective. I want it to be supported by, some thought, some kind of academic thought that something's been published on it, et cetera. I think if you're one to grab onto the latest thing always, just because it's like, well, is there anything to support that? Like, is there any literature on that? Is it maybe a great idea in theory, but is there any kind of proof that it might be the right thing to do? I'm not afraid to go first. I'm not afraid to lead the field. As long as it's something that's logically supportable, preferably with evidence, and the better the medical evidence is, then the easier it is to make that change. What's the problem we're trying to solve? What's going to be better for patients? Or the organization, like things that are better for the organization are better for patients. I know we tend to say, oh, always put the patient first. And also if we take better care of our people, if we are better stewards of our budget and all of those things all translate to being better for patients.
Yeah. So I'm Gen X. How about you?
Gen X also. Yeah.
I imagine you're leading a lot of millennials and even Gen Z.
Yeah, most of your workforce is going to be in that generation. I hear complaints from Gen Xers and baby boomers and stuff about, oh, you know, these millennials and Gen Zs, and, you know, they don't value work. You know, they're not the same as our generations, and diminishing, devaluing these folks, which I think is 100% wrong. Yeah, you know, I was a typical latchkey kid, right?
Yeah,
both
same.
My parents worked.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, you get home from school, you let yourself in, you make yourself a snack, you got to do whatever you got to do. And when it's on the weekend, it's like, okay, I'm taking my bike and I'll see you at dusk. You know, when the streetlights come on, I'll be home. We have this workforce generation that we have currently. They want to know why. And I hear this from some leaders that are like, well, they just do what they're told. Like, guess what? You wouldn't either. If you didn't see the value of something that you were doing, that you're proposing, if you didn't see why you were doing something, if it was just a, well, just shut up and color kind of a thing, you wouldn't do your best work. This workforce generation is much more apt to ask those questions. And I think that as leaders, that right there is the clue to us that we need to communicate the intent, communicate the thought process behind what we're doing. The people that you're leading, they always have to know that you would absolutely do anything that you ask them to do. And they also understand that, hey, we're an organization and one person can't do all those things. It's like, we work through all of us. When they're questioning that, it's like, hey, why is this? Like, well, I just don't have time to explain it to you. Well, okay, then you're failing as a leader, honestly, because you are not getting them to understand their piece of this mission and of this puzzle. You're clearly not seeing stuff that you need from their perspective that may give you clues as to how you can do things better. Also, we saw our parents, you and I saw our parents, how they worked long and hard and being away from home, being away from the family. And I think that this current workforce generation is looking for more balance. They don't want to be estranged from their children, their spouses, or they want to have some work-life balance that they want to go out and do things that they like to do. And we talk about, oh, you know, all this work stress, and, you know, we need to find work-life balance. And then at the same time, tell them, well, they won't be here 60 hours a week unpaid. I don't know why. So we as leaders, we need to do a good job of communicating to the workforce as to why this needs to be done and why that person, like why you need to be the one to do it, and what their piece is in that and how that is going to contribute to mission success. Also them knowing that they had a part in it, and you as a leader acknowledging their part in that success. I know, you know, a leader would say, well, great job, everybody, and all this kind of stuff. But no, really recognizing, hey, you know, you put in this extra effort on this thing, and this is why that mattered.
I think it's really fun when departments share data. I went to one of the CEs for Austin Travis County, and Iggy was showing, like, you know, this is how we're doing, and it was really fun. I mean, to see that, to me, would give me a lot of buy-in, just to see feedback and, like, the outcomes and things like that.
Yeah, like what you're doing works. There's a lot of, you know, poor Iggy. Oh my gosh. He's the one that's like seeing the chart completion rate and so on and so forth. And people are like, oh, why am I getting an Instagram about completing my charts and all this kind of stuff? But then also seeing, like, hey, here's the success. And it's funny, Andre Thompson, I was talking with him the other day, and he's like, the medical director, we harp on the charts. And it was when he started reading charts that he was like, oh, okay, now I get it now. I get why they're saying what they're saying. I can see that. So it's important to share the vision and the knowledge of that success. And so when you have this very large organization, it's very difficult for the CEO or chief or whatever to connect individually with hundreds of employees. So you have to understand that vision is being communicated through those deputies and through those frontline leaders. You have to make sure that message is being carried all the way down. There's nothing that'll undermine the effort of your workforce like their first line leaders saying, I don't know why they're having us do it. This is dumb.
Yeah, done. Dead in the water.
Like when your sergeant says, you know, I don't, you know, I don't want the lieutenant asked us to do this. This is lame. Immediately, that lieutenant is seen extremely poorly in the eyes of the enlisted men. They may have a very good reason for what they have asked them to do, but they haven't communicated the reason.
Another feature of millennials, maybe Gen Z as well, you've talked about work-life balance. You've talked about that they are good at asking why. And then I think another one is that they aren't particularly worried about hierarchy. You were saying you hate the word subordinate. They're not particularly worried. They will talk to anyone in the hierarchy in the same way.
Yes, and there's a rule for hierarchy in that you got to ask people to do things that they don't want to do sometimes. If they understand the end state of the mission and can get that and you can get their buy-in on it, sure. But sometimes you can't. Like sometimes it is a menial task or a thankless task or something like that. It doesn't seem to impact the overall mission that much, but it's one piece, you know, it's one broken window in a neighborhood. That one little thing that added up a lot of those pieces is going to impair the image or progress of our organization. So yes, and especially when there's an extremely time sensitive, critical thing, like you can't be storming a hill in a war and say, probably say, I need you guys to take the squad up this way and lay down fire on that. You know what I mean? Like, oh, but I mean, do we have to? Like, really? Like, why do we have to do this? Like, there has to be a certain amount of trust there, right? And that's where the building of rapport is so, so important. Building rapport is vital to leadership. The people who say, no, you have to be standoffish and all that kind of thing, I think they're really impairing their own ability to lead. You build that rapport, you build that trust. So then when you make a decision that not everybody agrees with or they don't see the reason for it, they're like, okay, I'm not sure I believe in it, but I believe in them. Because I believe in them, I'm going to do what they're asking me to do. Because there are times that you're not going to be able to communicate that intent all the way down through the entire organization simultaneously. But if you have the rapport, if you have their respect, they'll say, yeah, okay. Like, I don't really fully understand the literature behind this, but this is what we're doing now with this procedure, and I'll do it. There is that role for the hierarchy, but you got to respect the hierarchy. If they think you're capricious, or they think you're not listening, or they think you're not thinking through these decisions, then it's not going to roll out the way that you expect it to. At the same time, hierarchy significantly impairs communication up. If you do not have the safety, again, this comes back to the most important thing you can provide is safety. If you don't feel you're safe enough, there's lots of bosses say, oh, I have an open door policy, but do they really live it? Do they really go out to seek that input? If not, I mean, the amount of chutzpah it takes for you as an entry-level medic to go walk into the medical director's office and sit down and say to her, hey, I think this is a good idea, or I don't think this is working out the way you want it to. That takes an enormous amount of confidence, and most of them aren't going to do it, especially if that hierarchical relationship is emphasized so much along the way. It's like, you don't talk to the chief. You know, you talk to your first line leader, and then that works all its way up. The problem being that you impair your ability to get raw, unfiltered feedback. And that raw, unfiltered feedback is essential to success. If you are standing on that title, then the only feedback you're going to get is that which is filtered through others under you. And you're not going to hear what maybe the message that needs to get communicated to you. So flattening the organization is so important. And this is why I do not believe as a medical director that you should call me Dr. Pickett. You should call me JR. If there's something that you think is a stupid idea, then I want to hear it. It's a lot easier to say, hey, JR, I don't think this is working, man. Oh, why don't you think it's working? Okay, well, here's why. Versus Dr. Pickett, you automatically have a layer of hierarchy. It's a lot harder to overcome that. And people are a lot less likely to do it. But you flatten that organization. Talk as people. Again, a taco, a coffee, a margarita. You'll get that raw, unfiltered feedback that is so important to success. I have seen this with things that didn't work. Safety procedures that were born out of very good reason. Folks that came up with this plan to fix patient safety issues, but they weren't adhered to. Why? Because they weren't usable. Well, who's given the feedback that they're not usable? Because it's filtering to so many levels and it just never gets to you. You've seen Ford versus Ferrari?
Yes.
Fantastic movie. Matt Damon is in Mr. Ford's office, getting chewed out about their loss. He says, well, I saw that red folder go through this many sets of hands before it ever got to you. And that doesn't count these other dozen people that it went through before it got to you. So flattening the organization through rapport and not being like, well, I'm behind the desk. And yes, you come, you sit over here and you tell me what you think. You're not going to get what you need that way. But sitting on the back of the truck, on the bumper of the truck, drinking a cup of coffee with them, or smoking a cigarette with them if you smoke. Please don't. But but you get a lot done that way. And you really hear what folks think. And this is where you find your informal routes of communication and your informal influencers. You've got people within the organization who have informal authority. Maybe they don't have high rank, but they're people that others listen to. You're talking with them and they're asking that question and you explain something and they're able to explain it to others. You get rid of some of that formality of distributed message and so forth, and you're reaching right down to those line employees. Then they get it and they get why you make the decisions that you make.
You said that your dad gave you advice about slow to hire, quick to fire. I've heard that advice as well.
Yeah. My father, he owned his own business for 40 years and he's a small business owner. I learned so much from him, like how you treat people. And you may have heard me say it before, like if you work, you're going to put food on your table. You're going to feed your family. If you own your own business, then you're going to feed all of these other people's families too. And it's all about taking care of those folks. But he said, you should be slow to hire and quick to fire. We tend to be the opposite. We tend to hire somebody, interview them a couple of times, and then check the references and then bring them on board. And then things don't work out well, going through the process of, mentoring, and then human resources gets involved. And then it's like, oh God, it took so long to get them out. And so he says, be slow to hire, quick to fire. I say pump the brakes on that. Well, I think you absolutely should do your due diligence in finding out about the person and what are they like? What do they like to work with? Talk to people that worked with them. But I don't think that we should be quick to fire, because so many times we get into a role, maybe we didn't understand that groundwork that we needed to do. Maybe we didn't understand the pre-existing culture, that institutional experience, that the things that had been tried before. What the perception is of your role, not because of you, but because of the person who inhabited that role before you, then not fully understanding those. And then as you get into that role, like, okay, I'm going to make some mistakes. And, I want to have that room to make those mistakes and to learn from them and be better at it. Because honestly, if you're my employee, if I'm the CEO, if I'm the big boss and you're screwing up and I'm like, okay, I'm going to fire you and threaten you to do that. Again, you're not going to do your best work. You're not going to be as innovative and forward-thinking as you can. You're not going to make decisions when they need to be made. You're not going to make tactical decisions, because you're always going to be looking for approval from somewhere up above you. So I don't think that we should be quick to fire. I think we should be quick to mentor. It's important that people understand how they're perceived. And this is, again, where those non-standard, those informal leaders and those back channel communication routes are so important, because you can get a little bit more candid appraisal of how you're seen as a leader and how you're doing. And that can help you to adjust your course as you need to. It's always easy to say, after you've finally gotten rid of somebody, it's very easy to say, oh, God, thank God, okay, we're done. I should have fired him 6 months ago. Like, okay, but 6 months ago, did you know that they were going to that they weren't going to learn, that they were going to be recalcitrant to what you were teaching them, that they were never going to be the person that you wanted them to be? I think there are certain red flags, though, that we absolutely should be quick to fire. People who are toxic to those around them, folks who have a profoundly negative effect on the people around them, like, it's more than just I hate this person, like, the way they laugh annoys me or whatever, but Are they constantly undermining their leaders? Or are they constantly undermining their peers or their subordinates? Are they, you know, throwing others under the bus? Are they harassing people, bullying or sexually harassing anybody or anything like that? Yeah. Those traits, those are ones, yeah, be quick to fire. Get them out of there. There's a book on this called The No Asshole Rule. We talked about it before. You know, that 10% of your workforce are really, they're assholes. They're irredeemable. Like, they are toxic to the people around them, and you'll never fix them. The only thing you can do is isolate them from others that they could influence or get rid of them. I remember seeing surgeons throw instruments in the operating room, which to me is evident of a loss of self-control, and which is one of the traits as a leader you absolutely cannot have. And I remember when I went to residency, there was a surgeon who did that once, and they pulled him aside and they say, if you ever do that again, you're fired. Done. You know, that right there, you know, let's just set these expectations right now about this culture and what you can do.
And you're describing like the person that saw that one and done, the leader who intervened. They were very decisive. It's very clear, decisive. I know how I want to respond. Prompt, quick. This came up in our department where we had a student yelling, aggressive body language. We were kind of watching, how is our leader going to respond to that? And I think what we were hoping for is like decisive, cut it off at the knees kind of thing. And we were comparing, what would the last leader have done versus the new leader was more of, I think you called it tactical patience. I want to hear your thoughts on the leader that's decisive. We like decisiveness because it's like, okay, we can count on that. Like, they're going to take action versus they're going to let it ride and see how this evolves. And we're all kind of sitting around. What are your thoughts on being a decisive leader and that versus this tactical patience that you're talking about?
That's one of the dichotomies of leadership that Jocko Willink and Leif Bevan talk about, that so much about leadership, there's a dichotomy between this and that. And that's one of them. You want to be decisive. You don't want to sit on things too long when there is a very clear winner to the options that are before you. You have to know where your lines are. And I think that you have to decide in advance what some of those lines are. Like, what are certain things, you know, certain actions that are going to cause me to take this action? So in the example that you have there, if you have, this talked about the student
who's like unsafe and,
you know, yelling at people, yeah, and bullying, like that is just antithetical to our culture here. And that's somebody who draws immediate feedback, like throwing the instrument in the operating room. That's it. The tactical patience is, okay, well, let's see how this works out. Like, we all want to look for indicators that show that this thing is not going to work out, and therefore we need to shift gears. Also, you have to accept that when it comes to change, that there are going to be missteps. When you implement any new change, whether it's an organizational structure, or it's a new leader, or it's a new protocol, or anything like that, I mean, you have to allow for it. Like, if you're introducing a new procedure, like finger thoracostomy, for example, you have to know that there are going to be errors. Folks are going to do it wrong. They're going to do it at the wrong time. They're going to perform the procedure incorrectly. You can train them at the best that you possibly can, put them into situations, simulated situations, where they can exercise the decision that leads to that procedure and make sure that their physical performance of it is close enough to standard. But you're still going to have times when it's like, oh, you know, that wasn't the right thing. You don't say, oh, this is an indicator. Oh, we got to shut this down immediately. Like,
right. Which would be decisive, but not correct.
Right.
Because then you're just yanking yourself around.
Well, you are, because you're saying, hey, you can do this thing. And, oh, no, somebody screwed up. And so now we're going to shut that down. So now people are going to be afraid to do it. And there is always this institutional desire to be reactive, to be like, oh, okay, oh, no, you know, this terrible outcome happened. We got to stop this immediately and not do any more of it. Like, no, we can't give any more ketamine and right now. And there certainly is a role for a safety stand down of something when you have some really bad thing happen or some really bad things happen. Finding balance with that is so important. Being able to be circumspect to say, okay, first of all, let's not assume that this person was trying to do something bad. Let's assume they're trying to do the best job that they could, given the training and the guidance and so forth that they have. Almost nothing is as bad as it sounds right off the bat. Like, oh my God, did you hear what the medic did? Like, and then when you actually like dig into it, like, oh, okay, I can see how it got there. Mm-hmm. Having the tactical patience, again, when it's not somebody who's directly undermining other people, it may be that like, oh man, okay, this person's just come on board and they're not really well liked and how they do this job. And I am much more likely to say, well, give them a chance.
And that's tactical patience. And it takes kind of, we're going to work on this. We're not just going to react.
Being reactive, is it effective? Well, not terribly, because you know, you're turning things on, turning things off all the time. It's very confusing, especially in a large organization where you're doing that to people who had no part in whatever that bad outcome was. And like, okay, now I guess we're not giving ketamine anymore. And oh, we're giving it again. And it's like, okay. So like you said, you know, being yanked all around is so disruptive. You try not to be reactive. And at the same time, know, like, what are the things that you have to do a safety stand down on? You don't want to normalize deviance. And that's one of my favorite lectures of all time, is astronaut Mike Mullane talking to the IAFF about normalization of deviance and how like bad practices sort of creep in and then they become normal. And then that's when really bad things happen. And I don't mean it's just when faced with a problem. I mean, when it's faced with, hey, there's a change that we want to make to the protocol. Is this something that we should just go ahead and pull the trigger, do immediately? Do we have enough information? Do we need to stop, wait, gather more information that lets us make a better decision? I hate getting things lost in committee. While I want to hear people's thoughts and input, I want them to weigh in. I want them to see how things look from different perspectives within the organization and even from without the organization. I don't want to just get committees together for the sake of getting committees together and say, yeah, we formed a committee. Mm-hmm. Because then it's like, okay, we're scheduling around this committee and it takes so long to do it. What do we want from that committee? What we want is we want people to be able to sound off and tell you what will work, what won't work, how can it work better. In a group setting, sometimes that can be really synergistic. You can have input from this vantage point in the organization, and then somebody else is like, oh yeah, and then that reminds them, like, here's this input from my vantage point in the organization. I didn't think about what she's saying, but she's absolutely right. And that can be really helpful to have that synergy. But oftentimes the committee, its actions, like that how it's governance, and like, oh, we have to have 17 committee meetings to have a charter for the committee before we can move forward on anything. It's like, okay, it's going to be years before anything done.
Yeah. Just trying to get everybody together is a challenge.
Yeah, just scheduling in this day and age is hard enough. What you don't want to be is capricious, and you don't want to throw stuff against the wall to see what sticks. As a leader, you don't want to do that without people realizing that you've listened to them, you've heard them. And if you're decisive and rapidly decisive frequently, that can be a really good thing, because like you say, people are like, okay, cool, something's getting done. We've got some change, we've got some movement. But at the same time, you don't want to just throw stuff out like, yep, oh, well, why not? Well, let's do this thing. And I had a conversation with a former boss of mine. He was angry that I had proposed a change to the protocol. He's like, well, this, okay, we got these people together. We ran this data. We pulled this literature. We did all that kind of stuff. And unanimously, we're like, yeah, we should make this change. Put it on his desk, and he chewed me out over it. I'm like, why are you chewing me out over this? Like, here are all the steps that we did to get to where we are with this recommendation. And he's like, oh, you did that? Like, yeah. I'm like, look, I realize you don't think that I think things through, but I actually do, you know, and actually like look for buy-in and all that. And he's like, well, let's be honest, that's your brand. The reason that was hard for me to hear, because it was clear that he didn't listen to the when I briefed him that these are the things that we were doing. I didn't make a good enough case to him for him to understand that this was not a capricious decision. It was one that we were able to come to quickly. I think some folks think that, like, well, if a decision doesn't take months or years to come to, then right, it must not be a good decision. Like, well, no. I mean, do we know what we want to know? Mm-hmm. The other piece of that is to have the faith in yourself and in your organization to make adjustments as you need to. But understand that no plan survives first contact. You're going to discover things as you implement whatever change it is that you're going to realize, oh, I didn't realize that was going to happen. and so now I got to go back and let's tweak this. But have the faith in yourself that you can tweak that. And then it's going to be perfect right out the gate. It doesn't have to be. And I think that pursuit of perfection coming right out of the gate, I think it hampers a lot of our decision making and within organizations. And I've heard this a lot. Well, it's a big ship. You know, aircraft carrier doesn't turn on a dime. Like, I don't know. Have you ever seen an aircraft carrier doing evasive maneuvers? Like, they do actually turn very effectively. You know, have faith that you can make adjustments.
This is a left turn. My question is, would you follow you?
Would I follow me? His men would follow him, if only out of morbid curiosity. So,
would you follow you?
Yeah, I'd follow me. And the reason that I say that is I'm a product of the teachers that I've had, of the leaders that I've served under, and tried to do my best to use those examples to inform how I do things. And it's not to say I do all things right. God knows. Not everything I do is successful. Not everything I do is perceived well. But I think overall I'm pretty effective in this role. And but my starting and ending with everything is taking care of the people that you lead and being employee centered. And this is something that I think a lot of healthcare organizations particularly fail to realize. They're always like, well, we're taking care of the patient and it matters what the patient feels and what they get, et cetera. It's like, well, look, you want to take care of the patient, take care of your employees, take care of your people. They're the ones who are going to take care of the patients. And particularly when it comes to nursing, when they are the face of the healthcare organization for the vast majority of the time to the patients who are being taken care of, happy nurses make happy patients. And so take care of your people, create that safety, run that top cover for them, and never ever throw them under the bus.
Back to that Simon Sinek quote.
Yeah. And now, your people are going to screw up, and you have to have accountability. That's not to say that we gloss over particularly malfeasance. We don't. We correct folks where we need to. And I don't feel that you're not doing the job right if you're not punishing people. I think that's, I've heard that. I've been told that, that we're not revoking enough certifications. We're not decredentialing enough people. I think that is a horrible attitude to have.
I've heard a similar one in education. Like, if no one is failing, that it doesn't put the pressure on the other students.
One of my colleagues that I worked with, she was hired. The instructions that she got from our boss was, well, I need you to be the anvil. You know, I need you to, be the one that smashes people. I'm like, talk about setting someone up for failure, to set up a colleague for failure, to say that your job is to be bad cop. I respect and admire this physician so much, and her attitude towards quality improvement and empowerment and support of the medics and education and so on and so forth. And here we are reducing it to like, well, we got to show them who's boss. Kind of thing. I didn't find that out until long after we had worked together. And I was like, man, like, why would you do that to somebody that works for you? Like, why would you set them up for failure that way? And like, not surprisingly, she wasn't well viewed by a lot of folks. But I think because she was put into that position in a way that was not really not her instinct when it comes to how to lead, how to empower and support people.
What are your thoughts on managing conflict?
Work should not be free of conflict. If you're trying to create a completely conflict-free workplace, I think that you are shying away from difficult discussions.
Kind of like marriage. Marriage shouldn't be free from conflict.
No, because if you're avoiding conflict, then that's the goal. It's not the success of the organization. It's not the success of the mission. It's just the goal is to avoid conflict. Yeah. The problem is that in avoiding conflict, you avoid having the tough conversations. You avoid having the discussions that will ultimately lead to synergy and agreement and collaboration, because I'm locked in my things that, like, you know, I don't like this, that, or the other, but I'm not willing to bring it up because I'm afraid of creating conflict. Mm-hmm. The other parties, the other stakeholders in that are feeling the same way. So you end up just kind of working against each other behind the scenes rather than just bringing it out in the open. And the thing is, by bringing conflict out in the open, and when I say conflict, I don't mean you know, yelling at people or belittling each other or saying, you know, you're a dirtbag or
any like difficult conversation.
Yes. Because those difficult conversations are what will get you to where you ultimately want to be, which is agreement and to get you that win-win situation. And Chris Voss, who wrote Never Split the Difference.
Love that book.
Oh, it's great. I watched his masterclass and his videos and stuff. He says, like, you know, yeah, we want to get to yes. You know, getting to yes, that's the thing. But getting to no is really important because that's where the negotiation starts. If you are trying to avoid conflict, you're trying to avoid disagreement in your workplace, then you're really robbing yourself of the opportunity to collaborate and to lead and to break down barriers and to ultimately get what everybody wants in a mission, in an organization, in a proposal. The other thing is that there is some uncomfortableness in giving feedback, that you as a leader may have to have an uncomfortable conversation with a subordinate where you're telling them something that is probably not welcome news. In doing that, I sit down, I start, hey, look, I got to have a difficult conversation with you. This thing that you did, this is how that was perceived, or this was the downstream effect that you may not have anticipated. Again, it's always with the assumption that whoever was trying to do the best job they could and foresee the outcome or never saw that coming. I'm telling you this so that you know about it, so that you know, you're not thinking I'm stewing over it. I hate bosses that would stew over things and, like, you know, find out like 3 weeks later, like, oh yeah, you pissed off this person or whatever. It's like, well, how long have you known about this? Like, and why didn't I get the opportunity to mend that?
I'm kind of addicted to the difficult conversations at this season in my life because I grew up in the South, and that is a whole bunch of people that don't want to have difficult conversations. In my household, we didn't. We just didn't. And so what I've practiced as an educator, I have to give feedback, right? And so I studied it and I learned it. And now I feel more confident in how to navigate those conversations. What's happened is my relationships with the people that I'm having that difficult conversation with, it actually deepens after. So you think of it as conflict, right? But if you can successfully get through that conversation and get to the other side and both people feel okay, it's like, oh, we just did something hard together. The last thing I wanted to ask you about was your leadership during COVID. That seems like to me that was leadership on steroids because people were scared. Were there any lessons learned or mistakes or missteps during that time, or was it just practicing stuff you already knew?
No, everything was a learning experience, which I think is why it was so difficult for everyone. Obviously, messaging was so important. Messaging to the community, messaging to our employees. Like, we were having so many deviations from the PPE standard. It's like, okay, you're going in a full Tyvek suit, tromping through the woods for a person with a sprained ankle, but you've got a patient on a ventilator with a fever and shortness of breath, and you're wearing just a plain surgical mask and no eye pro. Like, you know, it's kind of all over the place because we're like, well, make good decisions and, you know, here's what you need to know. But we realized that folks needed some firmer guidance as far as, all right, this, we do in this situation. I mean, to some extent, like cutting off options, you know, having a lot of options seems like a good thing, but a lot of time it's not. Having fewer options to choose from helps to speed decision-making. Creating a unified PPE policy, creating that across all the public safety organizations with input from all of the unions. So when this policy comes out or that policy comes out, everybody knows, okay, whoever you are, like, you may think that I'm a crappy medical director, but if your union has also gotten to voice their opinion and concerns from the field and represented the workforce in that, then people are more likely to buy into it. And we found that deviation from the PPE was far less common after that. I really saw so much value in demonstrating that workforce buy-in to the stuff that we were doing.
I kind of remember y'all did town halls or something where it was like a Zoom call people could call into.
Mm-hmm. I think we all recognized that there was a need for continuous communication. There was so much collaboration between the organizations. Like, there were daily reports, there were weekly reports, and people had some idea of what the ground truth was of where we were and everything. And we found, too, that people reached in different ways. It was frustrating at times to see folks that, like, you're not reading the medical directives, you're not watching the town halls, you're not reading the daily summaries, you're not looking at the dashboards, and yet you're complaining that you feel uninformed. I can't help you.
They wanted a TikTok, JR. A TikTok.
What can I do? Well, so that's why we started the YouTube channel. In fact, the original idea was that when talking with the nursing homes, the nursing home task force said, our nursing home staff need just a video or something like that that's easy to understand, preferably in Spanish as well, because so much of the nursing home staff are primarily Spanish speakers. Created the YouTube channel. The first video I did was, hey, this is the, what you need to know about vaccination. That's the point we were at. I got another local physician, Gabriela Pachardo, who did the version of it in Spanish so we could have something to distribute. But in seeing that, YouTube is the second most used search engine in the world. So Google number one, YouTube number two. I saw that as, like, with our podcasts, a better way to reach out. We did a lot of our audio podcasts on COVID as well. And that was the reason that I created our audio podcast in the first place in the years before COVID, was reaching people who
don't want to read
it. Didn't want to read it. And some folks, like, automatically, if it came from the organization in email, they're just on principle not going to read it. Like, that was frustrating. But here's something that, okay, they can listen to it in the car and it's a little bit more approachable. And then with COVID, that became a really important part of our messaging to our workforces. And again, you take care of your people, they'll take care of everybody else. The power of that was really big. And I always have sought the input and buy-in from the union. Of course, Selena and I have done podcasts together and talked a lot about all kinds of various things, because it's important to me that workforce is represented in our decision-making. And, the union has the representatives of it, particularly the ones who do not feel comfortable talking with their chain of command. One of the big questions that came up was when the vaccines were available. So as an employee of one of the hospitals, we got the vaccines like a week before they were in mass available to public safety. So I had the opportunity to get my shot before the medics did, and I was conflicted about it because I was like, well, I mean, on the one hand, I want to lead by example with it and show that, yes, I'm willing to do it. I'm not willing to ask you to do something that I'm unwilling to do myself. On the other hand, I was worried that it would be perceived as, here, I'm taking my shot before everybody else because, oh, well, Dr. Pickett gets his first, because he goes right to the front of the line. And I didn't want that negative connotation either. So I reached out to the unions and to EMS union, fire union, police union, and said, how do you think this will be perceived? And what do you think they'll say? And all of them said, and not only does the union presidents, but also other board members of the union get their take on it. Every single one of them said, no, do it and let them see you do it.
Yeah.
And if you don't cut in that scene from Braveheart.
Oh, divide our forces. Do it. And let the English see you do it.
I will be very disappointed.
Do it.
Do it and let them see you do it. And they said, no, it's going to be very important that they see that you're doing it, because that bit of leadership, that leadership by example, is so important to them. And I remember seeing feedback on that. Somebody said, yeah, I don't really fully get it, but Pickett wouldn't steer us wrong on it, so I'm going to do it.
You wanted to be decisive, right? You wanted to decide whether to post or message with that vaccination, and that you sought the thoughts of others to help you make that decision.
Well, it's especially with big things, I want to see how it's going to be perceived, because then I can kind of change that message and or realize, oh man, I didn't see that somebody might see it this way. So getting that feedback was important. And I feel like, especially early on during the COVID response, we were very rapidly decisive. And like, it's an environment where we don't know much. And I think that people need to give their leaders some amount of space to make decisions that ultimately do not pan out well. And again, if your organization is paying attention to what they're doing and they're flexible and they're willing to do something that may not work out and then shift their strategy or just get rid of it altogether, then if you know, okay, if it's not working out, we'll change it. Or if it really isn't working out, then we'll get rid of it, but that will be okay. But I thought that we were able to be rapidly decisive during that time. We had flexibility and the money to do it. And as we settled further and further into that COVID response, then operations was being run by finance, which didn't make any sense to me from an incident command system perspective. It was like, well, okay, I need this thing. Like, I need baby formula for a patient that's in the isolation facility. It's like, well, it's got to run through this. It's got to be approved in this way. It's like, it's going to be several days. Like, well, no, that's not going to work. Like, that's not tactically feasible for what we're doing. One of the big things that, we take some grief over this. We had a patient that had to go to the isolation facility, and that was a facility that we had for folks who were diagnosed with or exposed to COVID that did not have a safe place to shelter away from others. They'd potentially be spreading it to others. Basically, a hotel that we had to house those people in it. We had somebody there who was an alcoholic, and they were a daily alcohol drinker and would go into withdrawal. And they weren't interested in the whole detoxification protocol and all that stuff. They just needed some alcohol, and they didn't have the freedom of movement to go out to the store and buy some. And so we ended up buying alcohol for that patient, for that resident, I should say. I wasn't really a patient at the time. And oh man, that, you know, you buy that on a pro card, like why you can't do this. You have to do it. Like, look, we're not doing it for morale. Okay. It's a medically necessary thing for this person. But wolf, did we like, here, this was a solution that was appropriate and really elegant and appropriately expedient for what was needed at the time. But then you've got other folks who are not in that same sort of emergency response mindset that didn't really fully understand that decision. And so, man, Keith and I, wow, we take some grief over that. that was his one story that he told at my going away party.
I was like, I've heard this story before, but yeah.
So that whole thing, it was, you know, seeing all these people that were working so hard on this thing. And I have a sticker on my coffee mug that says government is beautiful. And I know that sounds like a weird thing to say, right? Like, you know, oh, you're just a cheer for the man. So Don Hastings is one of our public health workers that has since retired, and great, great dude. And love that guy. He had a sticker that said that on his computer. And I'm like, explain this to me. Because of all the descriptions or adjectives I would use to describe government, beautiful is not typically among them. It's not the one that jumps to mind. He said, look around you right now. Look at all these people who are working on this response. And we're in the EOC, and there's dozens of people that are doing stuff in their various functional areas and so forth. He said, none of them are going to be famous. None of them are getting any kind of recognition or a bonus or anything like that. They're just doing their job. And all they're trying to do is save people's lives. That's it. That's their goal right here, is to save people's lives and to enable us to continue to function, to enable our government to continue to function through this crisis and use its resources wisely. That's it. There is no ulterior motive for all the things that people say about, politicians and they just want to make themselves money, and these government workers are not them. I was like, yeah, you're right. And that's the group I want to be in. You know, there's another guy from Austin Public Health, Alan Washington. He taught me a lot about how we were approaching this response. And I looked at this response the same way that you would any mass casualty. So you have the point of impact, like where the bomb went off or where the train crashed, et cetera, and you wade into the middle of it to help the most people that you can and kind of work yourself out to the fringes. I found that's what we were doing with this response. Like how can we impact the most people at once? Not necessarily the most vulnerable people at once. So this is clear on like our initial testing site. We created a really efficient, effective drive-through testing site that was great. It was, you know, functioned very well, like a machine. And then it's like, well, great. What if they don't have a car? Like, okay, well, they can take a bus. Well, it's not going to accommodate walkthroughs, so we have to create a walkthrough testing site. How are they going to get there? Well, they can take a bus to it. Like, okay, but the bus drivers don't want to be driving sick people around. Like, the first city employee that died from COVID was a bus driver. That's on their mind. They don't want to get sick either. Well, they can get a ride from somebody else. Okay, well, their friend works, so we got to find a way to do this off hours and, you know, and this and this and this and this. And what Alan said to me is, if you look at this response, the folks that are well-resourced are going to find their way to whatever it is, the testing, the treatment, the physician, you know, et cetera. If you start by those folks that are on the fringe, those folks that are not resourced, you design your response around them, then by default, everybody else is going to get taken care of. The well-employed, well-insured person with their own car and their own house that can buy groceries, and they've got the education to navigate the system and so forth. But if your system is designed to help the people who are the least resourced, then the people who are resourced are going to get in. They're also going to get into that system, and they'll be well taken care of as well. And I think that big paradigm shift, because this is a different type of disaster. Most of the disasters we train for, hurricanes, earthquakes, tornadoes, you know, human violent extremism, you know, stuff like that. And you go like right into the middle of it to help the most people that you can. That was an important lesson in this that I thank Alan Washington for.
I'm curious, and I know everybody listening is curious, you're physically moving, but on the internet, how would they keep in touch with you? Or like if you were to create educational content or anything, how are you still going to have YouTube, podcasts?
That's a good question. So I am starting a podcast with two other doctors, Phil Moy and Chet Karod from NEMSP. We're starting a leadership podcast. It's geared towards EMS and somewhat towards physicians, but there's a lot of bleed over into other leadership arenas, if you will. So that's something that we're planning out and planning all the episodes now. We're going to start recording that pretty soon. And I think it's going to be a lot of fun. We're going to start our own conversations in the first several episodes and then start bringing in guests. And I think that there'll be a lot of good leadership stuff. Phil and Chet are two guys that, for whom I have just such an enormous amount of respect, how their perspectives on EMS and clinical leadership and organizational leadership and so forth. And I am planning to do some more podcasting either through University of Utah or on my own. And it's going to be video because I saw the huge jump in listeners and viewers when I made the jump from audio to video. YouTube is it's such a huge point of access for folks. Going to continue to be involved with the Special Operations Medical Association and National Tactical Officers Association. And
do y'all have a title, you and Phil and Chet, you said his name was?
Chet.
Mm-hmm. Do y'all have a title?
The leader code or something like that, or the leadership code. It's funny, like going through, because there's a lot of podcasts and stuff like that, and we want to make sure we weren't stepping on somebody else's toes with their title, and wanted to make sure that it's unique enough that others aren't like, what the heck? And also generic enough that it's going to have broader applicability than just EMS. But really our focus is going to be EMS.
All right. I'll watch out for it.
Awesome.
Thank you.
Bill, when do we do this again?
When are we going to do it again? Uh-huh. Man, is the next time going to be over Zoom or something? We're not going to be in person. I don't know when I'll see you.
I'll come back for NEMSP.
So okay.
The NEMSP conference is in Austin every 3 years. So
yep. It's been so great having you in Austin. You reached out to me early on. I think you know, maybe I've been podcasting not very long, and you just started. We were both kind of new to podcasting, and we did our talking. No,
I absolutely hitched onto your coattails.
No, that's not true.
Don't even start. I was nobody. Stop. I was nobody till I met Ginger Locke.
But if you are a new listener to Medic Mindset and you haven't already listened to the talking teaching episode, that's one I've especially enjoyed.
I think these conversations are ones that we need to keep having. If we ever want to be a real profession, not just a sort of stopgap job, we need to be academically oriented. We need to have these conversations. We need to talk about what it is to have a career in this field, not just a job. And that's what I love about your podcast, is really getting into it. I mean, the guests that you've had on there is phenomenal. And getting into that mindset of what the true professional should be in this field. That is one of the lights. Like, if you ever talk about, like, okay, what are the good EMS podcasts? I'm 100% sure that Medic Mindset is the first one that comes up on everybody's mind for good reason.
Thanks for saying that. I think I'm really lucky to work with paramedic students, because I never lose sight of, because I'm watching them and what they hope it will be. You know, once you're in the field for a while, you lose sight of what you had hoped it would be. And I think that's some of what draws people to the podcast, is that the guests are so amazing and they still remember why they got into it. Sometimes there are people I interview have not been doing it that long. And it kind of refreshes that. We're like, oh yeah, like I did love this job.
Like, I remember when I still like had vision and hope for the future before it was beaten out of me. I think it's refreshing to see this through somebody's eyes who's new at it. And that's why I love to teach. And I love to teach residents and medical students, like, as they're discovering their future in this career field. That's why I think, like, doing the job as a medic without teaching, I think, is unfortunately selling yourself so short. Like, you know, because having that, the perspective of fresh eyes, like, hey, yeah, okay, this is a thing I've seen 100 times. But yeah, this is why it's cool, and this is what it could be. And there's, it's really is fascinating, and it's fascinating what we get to do and how we get to see people, take care of them, and the various things that we get to be involved in. When you see stuff that happens and kind of, oh, I'm curious what happened over there. But like, when you're in the middle of it and managing it and experiencing it, it brings more than just trauma. Especially if you believe in what you're doing.
Yeah. Thank you for your time. I'm going to scoot.
Get out. Get out of my house.
Oh, you're still there? If you're listening to this, you're one of my favorite listeners. You listen to the end because you know sometimes I add in a little nugget at the end. Sometimes outtakes, sometimes a call to action. And this time, I just wanted to share. Where have I been? For the last year, I've taken some time off from the podcast. I needed to refuel and recharge after a challenging season in my life, COVID and some other big life changes, and now I'm back. Thanks for sticking it out with me. I was never ready to let it go. There were days I asked myself if I wanted to let it go, and the answer was always a very clear no. I love this podcast, and there's more to come.
Are you recording?
I am recording.
All right. God. I just thought. Kill the recording for a minute.